Let's move from Ohio's economy to the world economy. Political and business leaders from around the world have gathered this week at a Swiss ski resort, Davos, for the annual World Economic Forum. The forum opened today, and we'll be looking at issues like world trade, currency rates, government debt, and inflation. We called economist Nariman Berevesh, who's one of the people attending. What is happening at Davos? Exactly how does it work?
Davos works on a number of different levels. I mean, at one level, you have the public meetings, panel discussions. And while those are interesting enough, that's really not where the substantive discussions take place. A lot of the very interesting discussions are in the private meetings and dinners and lunches between corporate leaders and politicians, between politicians and politicians. And sometimes there's actually progress made on some tricky issues. I think that, in the end, those one-on-ones, those bilateral discussions, as they're called here, is where a lot of the progress is made.
Can you think of something from a past year that happened that you realized 6 months later, 9 months later, even a year and a half later, that that was a meeting or that was a face-to-face that may have really made a difference in the world economy?
I think it's a little hard to tell on some of this stuff, but stuff that's come out subsequently, there were certainly discussions between, say, the Israelis and the Palestinians in the mid-1990s that opened some doors. There have been discussions on the financial crisis a couple of years ago in terms of bank regulation and so forth. But at the time, it's very hard to tell because, you know, a lot of those meetings are very, very private.
Would I be stepping too far to compare this to the Academy Awards for Global Leaders and Financial Experts? I mean, not that there are awards handed out, but everybody steps out on the red carpet. Everybody gets to be seen. Everybody looks at everybody else being seen, that sort of thing?
That very much is one level of this conference. But I think the reason why a lot of CEOs and politicians come here, but especially CEOs, is to sort of to take the temperature of other CEOs, if you will, to just get a sense of, are we making the right business decisions here?
There's been some attention to the sheer numbers of people that different countries are sending. What do you make of the fact that China and India are sending bigger delegations than they have in the past, while the United States is sending a smaller delegation, perhaps because it would appear unseemly at a time of high unemployment in the U.S. to have a lot of officials hanging around a ski resort?
I think there's a lot of symbolism to that that is not backed by substance. And by that I mean that certainly the quality of the people from the U.S. coming here is still quite high. American business people and European business people want to connect with their Chinese and Indian counterparts, and that's very important. I mean, I think everybody understands that that's where the growth is going to be.
Been an awful lot of anxiety in the United States, as I'm sure you know very well, about supposed American decline and an awful lot of discussion of a rising China, rising India, changing world order. That's the public discussion. What do you hear when you're in private with other executives, CEOs, and anybody else you may be able to talk with?
I think a lot of the business leaders are much more interested in the opportunities that China affords, the growing markets there. What they're most concerned about are the kind of barriers that China might be putting in place or has put in place that would make that business difficult. Will they have access to China's and India's markets rather than somehow or other that China is going to catch up with the U.S. or India is going to catch up with the U.S.? I think that's less on the radar screen for a lot of the business leaders.
And why is that?
Well, I think that their view of the world is if China grows, it'll benefit everybody. You know, the growing Chinese consumer market will be very good for U.S. businesses and U.S. employment in the end, for the Boeings of this world, for example, the Microsofts of this world, as will the workers in those companies. So I think they view this mostly as a positive thing.
Nariman Berevesh is chief economist at IHS Global Insight. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
The president last night used India as well as China to illustrate the manner in which the U.S. must work harder to remain competitive worldwide.
Meanwhile, nations like China and India realized that with some changes of their own, they could compete in this new world. And so they started educating their children earlier and longer, with greater emphasis on math and science. They're investing in research and new technologies.
India is the world's biggest democracy with over a billion people, and it's modeled itself in some ways after the U.S. We've invited Anand Giridharadas, columnist for The New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, to join us to talk about India on this India Republic Day. That's a holiday celebrating when India's constitution first went into effect after independence from Great Britain. Mr. Giridharadas is the author of the new book India Calling. He grew up in the U.S. and then moved to his parents' homeland, India, to report, research, and write. He still spends months out of the year there. Anand, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's wonderful to be here.
How do you think Indians will react to the president's shout-out last night at the State of the Union?
It's interesting. There were a lot of shout-outs. South Korea, I think, got the most. I think it got more shout-outs than gets in South Korea's own State of the Union speeches, probably, and China and India.
But still being held up as a country that the U.S. needs to keep an eye on in order to remain competitive and emulate in some ways.
Absolutely. And I think there was the interesting thing to kind of read from last night's speech is, in some ways, there was the familiar mantra that we've all heard of a threat of economic competitiveness. But I think President Obama very wisely also pointed out the kind of cultural competitiveness that we don't talk about as much. For example, when he talked about how teachers in South Korea are referred to as nation builders, that's not an economic threat. That's a cultural threat. That's a threat of people seeing the world differently and seeing it in ways that allow them to really pull their countries up. And I think what you're seeing in India and in China and many other parts of the world are countries that were in many ways dormant, not just economically, but culturally for long periods of time, and that are now waking up, ready to go, ready to fight.
Well, let's talk about the sort of the two faces of India today. You have this great quote in your book when talking about some of the people you came across in the Indian middle class. You said, quote, "They spoke as if they had just surfaced from an American Chamber of Commerce seminar. A rising tide lifts all boats. The government that governs least governs best." Do you think that's a widely held point of view?
Nothing is a widely held point of view in India, but I think what I was trying to get at is among those who have done well in the last 20 years in India and who therefore dominate the conversation to a great degree, there's a conviction that markets solve all problems. And this is in some ways an overreaction to the belief in the preceding 40 years that markets are no good and that the government and socialism solves all problems. So now India has kind of pivoted the other way. And it's interesting because in many ways, a lot of this, and you see this elsewhere in the developing world, consists of a misreading of the American experience. There's this kind of view in a lot of other places that America is just this bustling free market where the government does absolutely nothing. Whereas in fact, any Republican or Democrat in America will tell you the government does a whole number of things to provide a platform for the market. So that was what I was trying to get at in that passage.
You also talk a lot, and you also spend a lot of time reporting on this. China was one of the other countries that the president referenced as a country to keep an eye on. And, of course, China's president, Hu Jintao, was just in the U.S. How does China compare when talking about the same living standard issues you bring up for India? Because one of the things you've been writing about is in the basic sort of quality of life issues and addressing matters like poverty and hunger. China is, in fact, doing much better than India is. Why is that?
This is part of the fascination of what is happening with the rise of these two side-by-side giants, India and China. They began their experiments roughly around the same time, the last 20 to 40 years. They were both feudal, huge, massive, mostly rural countries, great ancient civilizations that are now trying to become modern in parallel. And, of course, one is the greatest democracy in the world and the other is kind of the greatest authoritarian regime in the world. And what is sad and striking on the question of poverty is that the big authoritarian country has done a lot better. It has eliminated, at least from its cities, and not just its cities, a kind of totally at the bottom degrading existence for millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people that is still all too visible in India. And I think that's something that people who care about democracy and care about the idea that it's a useful way to fight poverty need to kind of think about and reflect on.
You say that they need to, but are they? I'm reminded of, and I don't mean to trivialize the importance of the conversation, but I'm reminded of when Slumdog Millionaire became a global hit. But it kind of opened up some larger questions about why do these conditions exist to begin with? And, you know, an outsider, a non-Indian calling attention to these issues in a manner that, you know, some people found disturbing and other people just found embarrassing. So the question is, on this India Republic Day, is there a kind of reflection about these real disparities?
The fascinating thing there is it's a very successful democracy in terms of having those regular elections, not having coups and revolutions all the time. But India has built that very successful procedural democracy on top of a foundation, philosophical foundation, I think, of people not entirely believing that all men are created equal. A good friend of mine, Sudhir Kakkar, who's a phenomenal psychoanalyst in India, has written that India is the world's largest and most plural democracy with the world's most undemocratic people. India has the structures of democracy, but I think never implanted the idea that it is wrong for certain people to live in a certain way if we are all kind of God's children.
And finally, you know, the State of the Union is a time for a national assessment of where the country is. And of course, you know, there are different visions of where the country is, which is one of the reasons we heard three different speeches last night. Will there be speeches today for India Republic Day to have that national assessment? And what do you think some of those speeches will say? And taking your point entirely, then in a country of more than a billion people, there will not be one assessment, as there is not one here.
But there will be many speeches. There will be many media commentaries. There will be people in the op-ed pages and on TV and in their homes debating what the new India means. The thing to watch for is this. Over the last 20 years, it needed to be established that India could grow, that it could be dynamic, that it could get respect and power on the world stage, and that more importantly than any of that, it could begin to empower millions of its own people one at a time, give them their own personal independences, not just the independence from the British. I think the conversation of the next 20 years is, okay, we are big, we are powerful, we have money. Now who are we? What are our values? What do we want in the world now that we have power in it? And that question is beginning to happen, but it's not happened enough. And it's a very important question because once you grow and once you gain influence, it begins to matter a lot more to everybody what you want to do with it.
Anand Giridharadas has lived in and reported on India for many years. He's the author of the new book, India Calling. We reached him in Cambridge, Massachusetts today, and he's with us now from there. Anand, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Fashion shows were once highly exclusive events. Only the top buyers and icons and top fashion editors were considered front row material. But technology is changing that.
In the last 5 years, bloggers have gone from often not even being allowed in the room to certain bloggers now sit front row at the biggest shows that there are.
In a moment, we'll talk to two fashion writers about how bloggers are changing the way fashion is shown, sold, and even created. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. President Obama took his message about American competitiveness on the road today. First stop, the political battleground of Wisconsin. On the day after his State of the Union speech, where he stressed investments in areas like clean energy, Mr. Obama toured a windmill factory and a firm that makes high-efficiency lighting. He underscored the role, he says, the government can play in helping to make businesses more competitive in the world economy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
There's one competition President Obama probably wants to forget about, Sunday's NFC Championship game, in which the Green Bay Packers defeated his beloved Chicago Bears. Packer fans were quick to remind the president, though, as soon as he arrived in northeastern Wisconsin.
I have already gotten 3 Green Bay jerseys.
Mr. Obama wished the Packers good luck in the Super Bowl, and then he turned to the growing economic competition between the U.S. and fast-growing countries like China and India. He quoted legendary Packers coach Vince Lombardi, saying, "In this contest, there's no room for second place.
We've got to up our game. We're going to need to go all in. We're going to need to get serious about winning the future."
Visiting a renewable power company in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, Mr. Obama repeated one of his main arguments from last night's speech. He says government has a key role to play in the nation's economy. Maybe not the quarterback, more like an offensive lineman, opening up strategic holes for entrepreneurs to bolt through.
This company has also been supported over the years, not just by the Department of Agriculture and the Small Business Administration, but by tax credits and awards we created to give a leg up to renewable energy companies.
President Obama believes that government can be a partner in economic growth and job creation.
William Galston is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former advisor to President Clinton. He says past presidents, including Republicans, Abraham Lincoln and Dwight Eisenhower, have supported government investment in education, innovation, and infrastructure. Mr. Obama invoked that tradition in his speech last night.
America's the nation that built the Transcontinental Railroad, brought electricity to rural communities, constructed the interstate highway system. The jobs created by these projects didn't just come from laying down track or pavement. They came from businesses that opened near a town's new train station or the new off-ramp.
Mr. Obama is no longer talking here about shovel-ready construction projects to provide immediate work. Instead, he's talking about investments where the payoff might be years or decades away. Galston says Mr. Obama can afford that longer perspective now that, in the president's words, he's broken the back of the Great Recession.
During the first 2 years of his administration, Dr. Obama was trying to keep the economic patient from expiring. The tone of the 2011 State of the Union, by contrast, took a much longer view.
Political analyst Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College says the big challenge for the president will be how to pay for those new investments. At the same time, he's promising a 5-year freeze in discretionary spending.
The president had a problem. On the one hand, he wanted an activist government. On the other hand, he recognizes the fiscal problems facing the taxpayer.
The president may offer more details on how he'd pay for his programs in next month's budget. Meanwhile, Pitney says, congressional Republicans insist what the economy needs is less government.
One thing you can say for certainty is that we're not going to balance the budget in the next couple of years. And another thing you can say with certainty is that there's going to be a great deal of argument and disagreement about the appropriate size of government.
The president's State of the Union signaled even with a more Republican Congress, he's not backing away from that debate. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
As President Obama talked about what government can do to boost job growth and American competitiveness, he got some bad news today. The country's finances are in worse shape than previously thought. The Congressional Budget Office forecast a record federal deficit of $1.5 trillion for this year. NPR economics correspondent John Idstey joins me to talk about the CBO's deficit forecast. And John, the president last night said the economy is improving. So how to explain then the higher deficit for this year?
Well, the big reason is the agreement between the president and Republicans during the lame duck session of Congress to extend the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years. The CBO estimates that will reduce tax revenue by about $400 billion next year. And that represents a huge chunk of this projected record deficit. The CBO did say that those tax cuts are likely to help boost economic growth next year. So they're predicting the deficit will drop some in 2012, but it would remain above $1 trillion.
John, last night in the State of the Union, the president proposed a 5-year freeze on non-security portions of the federal budget to help with the deficit problem. First of all, what is that non-security portion of the budget, and how much of a difference will a 5-year freeze make in that sector?
Well, under the administration's definition, the non-security part of the budget includes all discretionary spending except spending on defense, Homeland Security, the State Department, and Veterans Affairs. It also excludes entitlements like Medicare and Social Security. So as the president admitted last night, the freeze only applies to 12% of the overall budget.
Right.
Now, according to the White House, the freeze will save more than $400 billion over 10 years, so around $40 billion a year, but not a lot when you're trying to fight annual budget deficits of more than $1 trillion.
And another thing, John, the president talked about last night was the expansion of a number of programs, including clean energy, high-speed rail. All of those would seem to be non-security spending. So how do you increase spending on those programs under the freeze that he's talking about?
Well, the president will do it by cutting spending for other programs in the category. This is not an across-the-board freeze. Every program will not be treated the same. The administration will be prioritizing, so some programs like high-speed rail will get more money and others will get less. And we'll find out more about the trade-offs when the president unveils his 2012 budget in a couple of weeks. But the White House says that all of the spending on the jobs and competitiveness programs that the president talked about last night will be done within the context of the freeze and won't increase the deficit.
Now, at the same time the president is talking about this freeze on discretionary spending, Republicans are also talking about budget cuts. How do those compare?
Well, the Republicans would cut more deeply. The Republican leadership plan is to go back to spending levels in 2008. That would be a 30% reduction across the board in the non-security federal spending immediately. Some Republicans, including members of the Republican Study Group, want to cut even more. But again, we're talking about making cuts in a small category of overall all government spending, so it's not going to solve the country's deficit problem. That's going to require tackling spending on Medicare especially and, to a lesser extent, Social Security.
And those perennial third rails
exactly.
of politics likely to happen?
Well, the president did say last night, and this is a quote, "We have to stop pretending that cutting this kind of spending alone, that is like non-security mm-hmm. spending, will be enough." And he made a reference to the work of his deficit commission, which outlined some ways to deal with Medicare and Social Security. But he doesn't appear ready to take the first step at this point.
And a lot more work to come in that department.
Yes.
NPR economics correspondent John Idstey, thanks so much.
You're welcome.